You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Stacey Abrams, the well-known Democrat from Georgia, got her start in politics working in the Office of Youth Services under Atlanta's first black mayor, Maynard Jackson. Jackson may never have been electable if it weren't for his progressive white predecessor, Ivan Allen Jr. The story of these two mayors and their families reflects challenges and transformations that Atlanta and the country have experienced over the last century. Gary Pomerantz is a best-selling author and lecturer in the graduate program in journalism at Stanford University. He's the author of Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn, The Saga of Two Families and the Making of Atlanta, which has its 25th anniversary this year. He joins me now to tell the story. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you. It's good to be on the show with you.
So what are Peachtree and Sweet Auburn?
Well, literally, they're roads. I think symbolically, they're the yellow brick roads for dreamers in the South, white and black. Peachtree Street was the street of the mansions of the white elite of Atlanta for generations, and later, skyscrapers. Auburn Avenue, which intersects with Peachtree in the heart of old downtown Atlanta, was the hub, a spiritual hub, commercial hub of black Atlanta. Everything from offices of prominent black attorneys and doctors, Reconstruction era churches when Auburn was in its great glory back in the 1920s, 30s, 40s. It was the center of black Atlanta.
And there are these two families. Explain their prominence. We'll start with the Allen family.
Well, you know, the story of Atlanta is burned during the Civil War, and after the war, it rebuilds. And you had freed slaves and broken Confederates coming into the city to rebuild their lives. The Allens and the Dobbs family, and I should say these are two of the defining political family dynasties in Atlanta's history, developed on opposite sides of a strictly segregated city. Both families, the patriarchs, arrived in the 1890s. Ivan Allen Jr. came from Dalton, Georgia, in North Georgia, in 1895, and he came to sell typewriters. He was a salesman. And he sort of quickly embedded himself in the white business community of Atlanta, and worked his way up. He did attend the 1895 Cotton States Exposition in Atlanta, where famously Booker T. Washington gave his Atlanta Compromise address. It was 2 years later that the son of slaves, John Wesley Dobbs, came to Atlanta. From Savannah, 1897 he arrived, and he arrived to go to school at the Morehouse Academy, what became known as the Morehouse Academy and later Morehouse College. And, I began my research on this, trying to tell Atlanta's stories. And Tenery, in the South, you are who your family is. Mm. And I tried to personify those two symbolic boulevards, Peachtree and Sweet Auburn. And by the way, it was John Wesley Dobbs who coined that term, Sweet Auburn, from the Oliver Goldsmith poem, that timeless poem. And so I decided that these were the two families with multiple generations of leaders in Atlanta who best, captured the spirit of those two famous boulevards.
Mm. I want to get a little more information about John Wesley Dobbs, so people understand how prominent he was in that black community. He was elected the Grand Master of the Prince Hall Masons. Now, what is the significance of that?
Well, the Prince Hall Masons were an organization founded after the American Revolution. And it drew from this was the black mason. So it drew from the black middle class and the black elite. And it was a fraternal organization. And it was sort of the launching pad for John Wesley Dobbs, who was by profession a railway mail clerk. It was a pretty important job. It was a federal job. He traveled on the trains delivering mails. He carried a gun with him. And to be a black Atlantan, in 1906, the year of the race riot, for instance, in Atlanta, was a big deal. It was a sign of status. And John Wesley Dobbs was he read avidly, and he wanted to be a race man. He shaped himself into that, and by that I mean racial uplift. He would become, an orator on Auburn Avenue. He'd take off that Dobbs brand hat, hand it to a bystander, and he would orate. He would talk about, he would quote W.E.B. Du Bois and Francis Bacon and Shakespeare, and he spoke with fire. You know, he had a big family, six daughters, all of them Spelman graduates and later college professors. One of them, Matilda Dobbs, became famously a coloratura soprano, desegregating in a lead role some of Europe's most prestigious opera houses. This was part of the Dobbs family was part of the Atlanta's black aristocracy, and Dobbs was the patriarch. You know, with that connection to the days of slavery, his parents had been slaves, and he grew up in summers as boy on the farm in Kennesaw, and now he would span all the way to 1961 when he died at the age of 79, and he became a prominent civil rights leader. And his spirit was best embodied, perhaps, on the male among the males of the next generation of the Dobbs family by his grandson Maynard Jackson, who in 1973 was elected the first black mayor of Atlanta.
And we're going to definitely get to his story. Before we do, I want you to tell one other vignette because I think it illustrates that even the black aristocracy did. I mean, they were not equal with the white aristocracy, and I think that the opening of the Gone with the Wind, the premiere there in Atlanta, kind of illustrates for me in this book so well the different experiences that the two communities, the black and the white community, had. Will you tell us that story?
Certainly. The Gone with the Wind, of course, was written famously by Margaret Mitchell, known locally in Atlanta as Peggy Mitchell. And they sold movie rights. And so in 1939, December of that year, the Gone with the Wind movie premiere happened in Atlanta. And the mayor of Atlanta at that time was Bill Hartsfield, and he would do anything he could to promote Atlanta. So he was, when this was secured, that this David O. Selznick production would come with all the actors to Atlanta, Hartsfield wrote to Life magazine and he promoted it to the press. He wanted all the press to come to Atlanta to see the greatness of his city. Hartsfield, by the way, was a municipal magician as a mayor. He was sort of Atlanta's Fiorello LaGuardia, mayor for decades. and so here comes the Gone with the Wind premiere, Gable and Vivian Leigh and Selznick. 300,000 people. Double the amount of people that fought, soldiers that fought in the Battle of Atlanta 75 years before, showed up to see the motorcade as the stars came from the Candler Airfield into Atlanta. Now, the Allens were, you know, involved. Ivan Allen Sr., the father of the future Atlanta mayor, was involved with the Chamber of Commerce. And there he was riding in the car with the governor of Georgia. And Ivan Allen Jr., his son, was sitting with his wife, Louise, next to Clark Gable at the Gone with the Wind Junior League Gala. The Dobbses, John Wesley Dobbs's wife, Irene, and their two youngest of the six daughters, June and Matilda, stood on the corner of Peachtree and Ellis Streets in the cold with a big crowd waiting to see the stars. But the cars were moving too fast, so they never really saw Gable. Mm. Gable hated the whole thing because he was basically a shy guy and he didn't want to be treated as a second coming of the Confederate General Joseph Johnston. Mm. But that night at the Junior League Ball, where Hartsfield had convinced many Atlantans to dress in the period costume of the days of slavery, the hoop skirts that that some of the grandmothers had worn, and he asked some of the men to grow whiskers in the traditional cut of that day for the men. Martin Luther King Sr., Daddy King as he was known locally, had his Ebenezer Baptist Church choir, 60 voices strong, perform at that segregated event. John Wesley Dobbs was furious. He counted Daddy King as a friend, but he couldn't believe that Daddy King, who had led a civil rights march only a few months earlier in Atlanta in 1939, would answer to segregation in this way by having his choir perform at this glitzy segregated event. And it's worth noting that among the members of that choir was 10-year-old Martin Luther King Jr. singing spirituals dressed as a field hand slave.
That's incredible. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor, and our guest is Gary Pomerantz. It's the 25th anniversary of his book, Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn, The Saga of Two Families and the Making of Atlanta. In just a moment, we're going to hear about how Ivan Allen Jr.'s views on segregation transformed, how that opened up a path for Atlanta's first black mayor. Stay with us. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor, and I'm speaking with Gary Pomerantz. He's the author of Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn, The Saga of Two Families and the Making of Atlanta. Let's talk about these two mayors. Ivan Allen Jr., did he always have political ambitions?
Well, he did. You know, his father liked to be called Senator Allen, even though he was just a state senator for a couple of years. He was a businessman in office supplies. He started with typewriters, and he grew the Ivan Allen Office Supply Company, which his son took over. And Ivan Allen Jr. was raised in elite Atlanta, elite white Atlanta, member of the Piedmont Driving Club. And by driving, I don't mean cars. It was days of horses and carriages. Mm-hmm. And he grew up in privilege. And you know, there's a moment in 1949 when Ivan Allen is 38 years old, Ivan Allen Jr., and he's going through the rites of passage of noblesse oblige, giving back to the community. And that meant that he was the head of the Community Chest Fund Drive, an annual drive. It became later, of course, the United Way. Some of your listeners may remember from the card game or the board game Monopoly, those orange cards, mm-hmm. Community Chest. Well, in those days in segregated Atlanta, 1949, with the Community Chest Fund Drive, as in all things, there was a black division and a white division. And the head of the black division, a banker named L.D. Milton, visited Ivan Allen Jr. and said, "Mr. Allen, we'd love for you to come to our event, our fund drive." And he saw Allen hesitate, and Milton, a wise man, said, "Mr. Allen, you think about it and get back to me." Well, 1949, Ivan Allen's 38 years old. He's thinking about running for governor one day, and he didn't want to make any missteps. Well, this Community Chest Fund Drive for the Black Division would be held at the Savoy Hotel on Auburn Avenue. And silly as it sounds today, Ivan Allen Jr. had to go around town talking to, you know, white leaders who he respected, and to say, "What do you think? Am I going to be jeopardizing my political future if I'm seen on Auburn Avenue, if I go there?" And he got mixed responses, you know. And finally, he went to 2600 Peachtree Road to speak to his father, Ivan Allen Sr., who was the son of a Confederate cavalryman from Tennessee, born in 1876. And for the first time, father and son had a deep discussion about race in the South. And what Ivan Sr. said was, "Ivan, our generation has completely wronged the black man, and your generation is going to have to deal with it. And it's going to be the greatest agony that any generation has ever faced." And Ivan Allen Jr. is listening and nodding, the dutiful son, and he looks at his father and says, "But Daddy, what about the fund drive? Should I go?" And his father shakes his head and he says, "Yes." He says, "But you know, I'm telling you to go, and I'm not sure I would have the courage to go myself." Well, he did go, and it was unlike any fund drive meeting he'd ever seen, because usually on the white side of town in the Community Chest Drive, they were boring, fact-based numbers. They were over right in an hour. But this was filled with emotionalism. Every donation, no matter how small, was cheered loudly. And Ivan Allen Jr. noted a woman sitting in the back who was wearing a dress covered with feathers, red feathers. This was called the Red Feather Drive. And she was like a spiritual siren. Every donation announced, she would stand up and say, "Hallelujah, amen." Well, needless to say, Ivan Allen Jr. had not seen this before at his first Presbyterian church on Peachtree. So now the event ends, and the Black Atlantans in the room form a receiving line to shake Ivan Allen's hand. And the woman wearing the feathers sweeps around the line, and Ivan Allen half turns, and she gives him a huge embrace. She was a big woman. He was a little man. He was like lost to sight. And she says, nearly shouting, "This is my baby. I brought him into the world, you know, years ago." And she had. Her name, Bertha Lewis. And when Ivan Allen's family physician was unable to get to the Allen home on West Peachtree in time in 1911 for his birth, Bertha Lewis delivered Ivan Allen Jr. The first hands to touch him were hers.
And he had no idea?
He had no idea. And what's he to say, right? You know, how are you? How have you been? But it's one of those moments that leads to an epiphany, because within days he wrote out a check for $500 to the Urban League, you know, and his conscience was stirred.
How did that translate into his professional career when he's elected mayor? Were there Black officials who he was dealing with on an equal or almost equal playing field?
Well, you know, he was the head, as his father had been, in 1917. In 1960, Ivan Allen became the head of the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce. And now you have the real stirrings of the modern civil rights movement. And there are some protests going on and late night negotiations. Ivan Allen had grown up knowing Black Atlantans as butlers, chauffeurs, yard men, and maids. But now, for the first time in his life, he met the likes of the Reverend Martin Luther King Sr., the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Morehouse President Benjamin Mays, the banker L.D. Milton, the lawyer A.T. Walden. These were men who were his intellectual equal and more. And he began to change. He began to see the wrong of segregation. You know, Tenery, there are people who would say you can't change on such an issue. I disagree. I mean, to deny that capacity to change is to deny the human capacity to change at all. And so Allen began to change, and he becomes historically the bridge from the Old South to the New in Atlanta.
I wonder,
because as mayor in the 1960s, he led Atlanta through some of its most racially tumultuous times, and kept the peace.
You referred to the Dobbs daughter, and I don't quite know how to say her name the way you said it,
Matawilda,
who became the opera star. And there's this intersection when Ivan Allen is Jr.'s the mayor that really is a very public showing of a kind of a new world. Could you tell us the story of her premiere at the opera in Atlanta?
Well, one of the interesting things about researching this book, and there were many interesting things about researching this book, many finds and revelations, was to think, you know, these two families were living at times blocks apart and never met. That's how strict segregation was in Atlanta across the decades. Mm-hmm. Now Ivan Allen Jr. becomes mayor. And by the way, when he becomes elected in 1961, it's the defining moment of modern Atlanta, because he ran against a segregationist named Lester Maddox. And if Maddox had won that race, safe to say, Atlanta would not have hosted the 1996 Summer Olympics 35 years later.
Really?
Its progress would have been delayed, if not stalled eternally, because segregation was clearly holding Atlanta down. It was holding Atlanta back. Atlanta would have gone nowhere with Maddox. And Maddox, by the way, won the white vote in 1961 against Ivan Allen. It was the Black vote that saved Atlanta from itself. Ivan Allen took 98% of the Black votes in Atlanta in that race. And so he becomes mayor, and it's a highly charged campaign. Lester Maddox goes around on the campaign trail carrying a pair of pantyhose, and he sprayed them silver and said that Allen was a silver-stockinged man. He didn't understand the common people. And so in 1962, Matawilda Dobbs, a coloratura soprano, comes back to Atlanta. And Allen goes to see her perform at the city auditorium. And it was the first time that I could document in 65 years that both families, prominent in the city, had met. And they met because Allen walked onto stage as the official greeter and welcomed Matawilda Dobbs back to the city, to her hometown. And he presented her with a dozen roses and said, "You have brought honor to our city, across the nation, across the world." And it's a big moment in the book. It's a big moment in Atlanta's history. I say that because it's just filled with symbolism that finally Atlanta begins to open up, you know, like the rose and blossom. And new things are possible. The book, Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn, is really told intimately through these families in their smaller moments and, you know, having them said at big moments like, you know, the funeral of Martin Luther King in 1968 or the Gone with the Wind premiere. That's the backdrop. That's the setting. And it tells the rise of Atlanta. It tells the evolution of Atlanta's racial conscience through the intimate stories of these two families.
Mm. And on a larger national scale, Ivan Allen was there to calm Atlanta when Martin Luther King was assassinated. With the family, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Allen is watching TV and gets word that Dr. King has been shot in Memphis. It was still unknown if he had survived or not. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his thought was, first Kennedy, now this. And he turns to his wife, Louise, and says, "I'm going to go to Mrs. King." And she looks at him and says, "I'm going to go with you." And he looks at her and said, "Are you sure?" And she says, "I think sometimes a woman can do better with a woman." And so they drive in the rainy night, April 4th, 1968, to the King home. And, you know, Ivan Allen is going to take Mrs. King with police escort to the Atlanta airport because she was going to catch an Eastern Airlines flight to Memphis where Dr. King had been shot. And Ivan Allen holds the umbrella over Mrs. King's head as she goes into the car and they go off to the airport. It's when they're at the airport that Ivan Allen is paged and he gets word from Memphis from an official there, "Mayor Allen, I am calling to tell you that Dr. King is dead." And Allen hears this and says, "I need an official confirmation. Reconfirm that for me, please." And said, "Dr. King is dead." Okay, so he hangs up the phone and he goes back to Mrs. King. And Mrs. King is in the with Dr. King's secretary in the woman's lounge of Eastern Airlines terminal. And they come out and Ivan Allen says, "Mrs. King, I have been told that Dr. King has died." And Mrs. King, Coretta Scott King, is weeping. And Louise Allen instinctively reaches, you know, for a paper towel to give to her because they're right there at the opening of the ladies' lounge. Mm. And when she does that, Ivan Allen takes his silk handkerchief from his pocket and grabs the paper towel and gives Mrs. King his silk handkerchief. And it turns out Mrs. King does not go to Memphis because her husband has died. She said, "I need to go back home to the children." And Ivan Allen goes back to Mrs. King's home, and he's sitting in Dr. King and Mrs. King's living room that night watching as LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, President of the United States, addresses the nation, and riots begin to break out across the nation.
And what does he do for Atlanta?
Well, then the moment comes. You know, 5 days later, there's going to be a funeral, and he's thinking 10,000 people will be there. It turns out 150,000 people were there. People from all across the land. People came in from, you know, busloads from the Midwest and the South. Famous people, Richard Nixon, Bobby Kennedy, who would be assassinated himself 2 months later, Will Chamberlain, Harry Belafonte. I mean, they packed the street on Auburn Avenue just outside of the Ebenezer Baptist Church. They all wanted to be inside for the funeral. They couldn't all be there. There's a phone call that comes the night of the King assassination from Washington, D.C., and that phone call is placed by Bob Woodruff, the Coca-Cola titan. He's sort of the Wizard of Oz in Atlanta, and Alan had grown up worshiping him, and I found letters from Alan to Woodruff that when he was mayor that began, "Dear boss," that's the salutation. It was that kind of a relationship. And Woodruff had been with LBJ that day in the White House when LBJ got the notice delivered to him by hand that Dr. King had been shot. And Alan and Woodruff begin to talk about what's going to happen in the days ahead. And Woodruff says, "Ivan, the world is going to be looking at Atlanta for the next 5 days. You need to do whatever needs to be done, and it will be taken care of. Just make sure it's done right." Mm. And that's him, Woodruff, saying whatever security needs to be paid for extra above and beyond whatever the Atlanta police force can provide, Bob Woodruff and Coca-Cola will pay for it. Because it mattered to Woodruff that Atlanta was civilized, that name, Atlanta, stamped on every one of those red and white Coca-Cola cans shipped around the world, was a civilized place, the best place in the South, the leader of the South. And so Alan, you know, went out to the Atlanta University Center, the home of the six black colleges, most prominently Spelman and Morehouse Colleges. The students were about to march, and he wanted to march with them. They said, "Mr. Alan, this is not a white man's march. We're marching," you know, and Alan said, "Well, I want you to know you're free to march, and we will make sure you're free to march." And he was in the car, you know, six blocks ahead, leading and looking back. And Alan sat in the Ebenezer Baptist Church for Dr. King's funeral. Then the most remarkable funeral cortege ever seen, perhaps, certainly in Atlanta, marches from the Ebenezer Baptist Church all the way to the west side to Morehouse, where another ceremony was held and Mahalia Jackson sang. And Alan walked out there with George Romney and a lot of the other politicians, and he went back to City Hall. That morning, he had looked out from his office window and saw the governor of Georgia, Lester Maddox, the same man he had defeated in the 1961 Atlanta's mayor's race, was now governor, and Maddox went out to raise the flag from a respectful half staff to the top of the pole. He didn't do it because he saw the TV cameras watching him. But Alan just thought, you know, my God, if he were running the city right now, what would happen today?
You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor, and we're hearing about the history of race relations in Atlanta through the stories of two prominent families, one black, one white. Our guest is Gary Pomerantz. He's the author of Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn, The Saga of Two Families and the Making of Atlanta. Coming up in just a moment, we'll meet Atlanta's first black mayor. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Our guest is Gary Pomerantz. He's the author of Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn, The Saga of Two Families and the Making of Atlanta. Will you introduce us now to Maynard Jackson, who is Atlanta's first black mayor? But I want to meet him back in school because he was something of a prodigy right from the get-go, I guess.
Well, he was not only a prodigy, but he was the first grandson born to John Wesley Dobbs, who, remember, had six children of his own, all daughters. And Dobbs desperately wanted a son. And he would have nearly 20 grandchildren by the time all the counting was done. But Maynard Jackson was clearly special from the beginning. He was massive. He was about 6'2", more well over 300 pounds, immaculately dressed. His oratory was refined, and it was soaring. Maynard Jackson didn't always speak to the people, he spoke to the heavens. And it came from Dobbs. John Wesley Dobbs and Maynard Jackson had been standing together in 1948, in the spring of 48, when Atlanta hired its first black police officers. Now, Atlanta claims to be first in all things. The old joke is if Atlanta, you know, sucked as hard as it blew, it would be a seaside city. And Atlanta claimed to be first, but it wasn't first in this either. Other southern cities had already hired black policemen. Well, now Atlanta has its great day, and it only happens because William Hartsfield, Bill Hartsfield, the mayor, had told Atlanta's black leaders, among them John Wesley Dobbs, if you can get 10,000 registered black voters in Atlanta, I'll get you your black police officers. To Hartsfield, it always came back to politics. This is what it's about. Well, they got those 10,000 black voters. John Wesley Dobbs, one of the leading voter registration prophets on the Auburn Avenue side of town, and now he sees this revelation, really. These young eight black police officers in their crisp blue uniforms walking out of the Butler Street YMCA, and there's a crowd of black Atlantans there to see him. And there's almost this hush of reverence there that, wow, it really happened. We have black police officers. They were changing in the Butler Street YMCA as opposed to the downtown police precinct because it was felt that the white policemen didn't want black officers in their precinct. And this was the way to start it before you generally segue into true integration. Mm-hmm. Well, now these officers are walking the streets, beginning their patrol, and there's a voice that the young Maynard Jackson hears. And Maynard Jackson's 11 years old on this day. It's his grandfather, John Wesley Dobbs, and he says, "Great God Almighty, look at those black boys in those blue uniforms." Mm-hmm. And then his voice raises louder, and he says it again. You see, to Dobbs, this moment was a liberation. It was emancipation. It was proof of the power of the vote. You know, now Dobbs always talked about books, ballots, and bucks. That was the way to true freedom for black Americans. Mm-hmm. And here was a proof of the power of the ballots. And Maynard Jackson's taken this all in. And he has other such moments with his grandfather. His grandfather was very demanding on him. He held that bar high and said, "You surmount it," you know. And there's a time when he said Maynard Jackson makes a passing reference to the poem "Will" by Ella Wheeler Wilcox, and that was Dobbs' favorite. And Dobbs says, "You know it," and Maynard Jackson said, "Well, you made me memorize it." And Dobbs said, "Let's hear it." And Maynard Jackson said, "Now?" And this was 1960, the year before Dobbs' death. Maynard Jackson would have been 22 years old. And so Maynard Jackson nervously begins to say it. You know, gifts alone count for nothing, or gifts count for nothing. Will alone is great. All things give way before it, soon or late, and his hands are moving in broad arcs. And his grandfather is testing him again. He tested him over and over. And so Maynard Jackson becomes a lawyer.
And now, you have to just mention how old he was when he went to law school.
Well, good point. Maynard Jackson was 14 when he went to college at Morehouse University, and he was 18 when he went to law school, and he struggled in law school. He didn't make the grades at Boston University, and he ended up going to North Carolina Central to get his law degree. And he's theatrical. And there are people who are going to see him as mayor and just think this is a guy who likes to grandstand without knowing his background, his history, his family, mm-hmm. the people who shaped him.
And you know, pushed his father, him. And pushed him, it sounds like.
They pushed him hard. Yes, mm-hmm. he was pushed hard. And he has the moxie to run against Senator Herman Talmadge for the U.S. Senate seat in Georgia and lost as a very young man, and then ran without the support of Atlanta's black power structure. He didn't get their great, their good graces to run, and he wins as vice mayor, and then he runs for mayor of Atlanta in 1973, and it's quite an electrifying campaign against the incumbent Sam Massell, and Sam Massell is losing against the tidal wave of racial history. He's losing against a 35-year-old upstart, Maynard Jackson. Mm-hmm. And so his campaign crafts the slogan for the runoff election, Atlanta's too young to die. Atlanta's too young to die. Well, Maynard Jackson took that and ran with it. I mean, it's filled with, you know, racial overtones.
Mm-hmm.
And Massell was waxed in that runoff, and Maynard Jackson has his big moment. It wasn't so much a inauguration as it was a coronation. The Dobbs family was there. There were dozens of members who were there. John Wesley Dobbs was not there because he had died about a dozen years before, though his name was evoked. And Matilda Dobbs was there to sing. And it was 5,000 people there, and 90% of them black Atlantans. This was quite a moment in the history of Atlanta. It was the first black mayor. It was a breakthrough. And Maynard Jackson, as I say, spoke not only to the moment, but he spoke to the heavens.
I just imagine such a dramatic accomplishment would have a lot of expectations, really maybe inflated expectations.
Well, you're exactly right, Henry. Yes, for sure. I mean, Maynard Jackson, in my interviews with him for this book, you know, he said what he faced was, one, he was 35 years old, and this is a lot to take over. He had a U.S. economy that was reeling with inflation, high unemployment. But more than that, he faced exaggerated expectations in Atlanta's black community and exaggerated fears in Atlanta's white community, particularly the business community.
And I guess, I mean, he got right to it. He wasn't shy about controversy that might, I don't know, realize some of the fears from the white community. He wanted to get the police chief out of there right away.
He did. And the big project of his administration was building of the Atlanta airport. And Maynard Jackson was quick to say, I am not a gradualist. You know, he wanted to right the wrongs of 100 years and more, many of them racial in nature. And so he established a 25% quota in minority hiring in contracts at the airport and in all municipal contracts. And the white business community wasn't happy about it because this meant they were going to be, that community was going to be losing money. But Maynard Jackson says, it's not that you're going to get a smaller part of the pie. We're going to expand the pie. And so there was this struggle. The police chief, John Inman, a white police chief, was inherited by Jackson, and he wanted to change the police chief. And he did change to a so-called super chief, a former Morehouse College classmate named Reggie Eves. That didn't end well. It was a struggle for him. And Maynard Jackson was reelected in 1977. And he got that airport built, as he would proudly boast, under budget and on time. And that airport is critical to Atlanta's business development. The old line being, if you're from Atlanta, or if you die and you're going to heaven, you need to connect first in Atlanta on your way. And so there was that. But when Maynard Jackson stepped down after that second term, none of the white law firms in Atlanta would hire him. And he ended up being hired by Chapman and Cutler, a Chicago-based firm. Mm. So there was a payback there,
mm-hmm,
that was waiting for him.
Mm. Sometimes when you're mayor, I mean, you can have your goals of what you want to accomplish, but sometimes things happen, lots of times things happen that you are just not in control of. I was a child in Virginia during the years of the Atlanta child murders, and Maynard Jackson is the mayor of Atlanta during this time. How did he respond to this crime spree that was terrorizing people?
It was terrorizing, and young black boys and a few young black men disappeared, 22 in all, over a period of several years. And in the end, Wayne Williams, a young black photographer who often showed up at crime scenes, was convicted of a couple of those murders, and the others were sort of generally assumed to have been committed by him. It was not, they weren't dotting all the I's and crossing the T's on this. They just wanted to move past this. And it was a terrifying time for black Atlanta. You know, mothers and fathers holding their young black children close by, you know, for fear that walking down the street or going to a public park would be there. And this was, something Maynard Jackson as mayor in his second term, and it was happening from 1979 to 1981, had to deal with. And, you know, cities are a bit like people. You know, they have their lifespan. You know, they have childhood and they go through adolescence and then they become adults and they have memories. And there are memories deeply embedded in cities. And for black Atlantans, the 1906 Atlanta race riot looms large. When there were exaggerated, full lies about black men raping young white women, and white mobs started marauding across downtown Atlanta, beating and killing black Atlantans. And they moved down Auburn Avenue, the white mob. And John Wesley Dobbs, who was married that year, 1906, a railway mail clerk living on Auburn Avenue, was barricaded inside his front door holding his gun to protect his family. And as it turned out, you know, the torch light crowd, you know, they're carrying torches down Auburn Avenue, turned away before they got to Dobbs' house. But his heartbeat is racing. Mm-hmm. And those moments are told to the next generation and the next generation. And here it is, you know, three quarters of a century later in the missing and murdered children's case. And this is pulsing beneath the surface of black Atlanta that, you know, this is dire and we need to protect ourselves. And, you know, why does this happen?
And there's this famous picture because I feel like people feel helpless and they look to the mayor to do something. And there's this famous picture of Maynard Jackson sitting behind a pile of money, of cash. It covers an entire table and he is flanked by a black police officer and a white police officer. What was that about and why was it so important that he did that?
Well, he wanted the word out that, you know, anything to solve this, and we will pay this amount of money for any tips that lead to the apprehension and conviction of whoever is responsible for this. And it was a great visual. Cash, you know, wads of cash stacked up on that table. And you know, the two men, as you say, standing beside him. But if you look at Maynard Jackson's expression there, it's one of you know, confusion and pain and what do I do about this? It's all in that expression, and it was a severe time in Atlanta, one of its darkest hours.
We're speaking with Gary Pomerantz. He's the author of Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn, The Saga of Two Families and the Making of Atlanta. Now, you got to meet both of these men, Ivan Allen and Maynard Jackson. I would like to hear about the experience that you had firsthand with Maynard Jackson in a cemetery near Kennesaw Mountain. And it's a really beautiful story, and it's a visual story. So if you could paint that picture for us of why it was so powerful for him to be in that cemetery.
Well, let me take you back one step and tell you what led to that moment. Maynard Jackson did come back and win a third term in Atlanta in 1989. And it was not a successful term, 1989 to 1993. And I had started my book project in 1991. So he was still mayor. And I couldn't get an interview with him. I kept trying. I kept going through his press aides. And finally, I did something that I really didn't want to do. I photocopied a sheet of paper that I had found, a document that I had found in the Georgia Department of Archives. And it was a profound document because It was the inventory of the estate of the white farmer Josiah Dobbs from 1851. He had died that year. And in Cobb County, Kennesaw area, now part of, you know, North Atlanta metro region, and it listed his 13 slaves, the most valuable. A Negro man, Wesley, $800. That was a man who took on the name of Wesley Dobbs upon emancipation, took on his slave master's last name, which was commonly done. So I gave it to Maynard Jackson's press secretary, this photocopy. And he said, "My God, has Maynard seen this?" And I said, "No, and I don't mean to diminish its meaning by handing it to you in this way and trying to use it as a drawing card to lure him. I just want him to know how deep I'm going with this story." Well, he showed it to Maynard Jackson, and within 2 days, we were set on a Saturday for an interview. And that was the day that I chose to take him to a remote, century-old graveyard in Kennesaw. Buried there were the slaves that had watched General Sherman and his long line of bluecoats march into Marietta en route to Atlanta in 1864. And I had been there, and I had found the graves of that man, that field hand slave, Wesley Dobbs, who died in 1897, and his wife, Judy Dobbs. And the heavens moved when I came upon them. And Maynard Jackson had never been there. So to call it a cemetery, well, it was a cemetery, but it was really a densely wooded forest. So I took Maynard Jackson out there, and he was immaculately dressed in a three-piece suit, his collar, his tie knotted, you know, at the throat, and a pen in, you know, clipped to his shirt. And I would pull back the vines, and this massive man, 6'2", 350 pounds, would step through. And we walked deeper into the woods, and every 10 steps we took, we went back another 20, 25 years in time until we're standing amidst the tombstones of those slaves who watched Sherman come to town. And when I pointed to the tombstone upright of Wesley Dobbs, Maynard Jackson gasped, and he held his hand to his mouth, and he read aloud, "Wesley Dobbs died February 5, 1897, age 78 years. And there was a powerful moment where he stepped forward and reached to touch the top of that stone. And he pulled his hand back, almost as if it were a flame, too precious to touch. And then he held it with one hand and both hands almost merging with it. And I'm pulling myself back, trying to give him this very personal, meaningful moment. And what I'm seeing is the South's first black mayor standing in the shades of dogwoods and scrub pines that had grown literally from the graves of his slave forebears. And that's when the heavens moved.
Powerful. We're almost out of time. We've been talking about two streets, Sweet Auburn and Peachtree. Do they ever intersect?
Well, as I say, literally, yes, they intersect. They intersect right in the heart of downtown Atlanta. They intersected on that night at the Atlanta City Auditorium when Matilda Dobbs came home and Ivan Allen Jr. presented her with a bouquet of roses. You know, it's 25 years now since my book came out, and we're having some events in Atlanta to commemorate the 25th anniversary this fall. And the city has sponsored a contest among architectural firms to build a memorial at the corner of Peachtree and Sweet Auburn to honor the two mayors and the spirit of their time as mayors, you know, a spirit of harmony. At least that's the ambition. And so I can also tell you that in 1996, when my book came out, we had a party in downtown Atlanta, and it was a great party. And what made it great was it was held in a restaurant, the City Grill at the Hurt Building, just a block and a half from where Peachtree meets Sweet Auburn. And that night, we had four Atlanta mayors there, Ivan Allen and Maynard Jackson being two of them. Their families were there in big numbers. Coretta Scott King was there. The Spelman Choir was there. You had old Atlanta, new Atlanta, black Atlanta, white Atlanta, all in that room for that moment in time. And, you know, I didn't miss the meaning of that. Neither did I miss the fact that when the night ended, everyone got back into their cars and went their separate ways. That Atlanta, at that time, 25 years ago, remained a city integrated by day, but segregated in matters of the heart, namely where you live, where you pray, and where you're buried. And you know, this is the quest for Atlanta. It was the quest then. It's the quest still today. You know, Dr. King's beloved community, that's what he called it. And that's where Atlanta ought to be arcing toward.
Gary Pomerantz is a best-selling author and lecturer in the graduate program in journalism at Stanford University. This year marks the 25th anniversary of his book, Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn, The Saga of Two Families and the Making of Atlanta. Thank you for sharing this important story with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on the show. It's a great pleasure to be on with you.
This is Constant Wender. I'm Tenery Taylor.
Switching gears now, here on the show a while back, we heard a story about a man who saved the lives of preemies using incubators. And that would all be well and fine, except he did it as part of a sideshow, you could say, at the 1904 World's Fair. His name, Martin Cooney. Was Martin Cooney a hero, or did he exploit these babies? Well, it's a fine line, says Don Raffel. Raffel is author of The Strange Case of Dr. Cooney, How a Mysterious European Showman Saved Thousands of American Babies. Here's part of our conversation.
He would claim he was doing it for scientific purposes. He was trying to educate the public. He claimed he was making propaganda for preemies. The medical care in those places was impeccable. It was better than you could get in any hospital at the time for premature babies. But at the same time, he was what you'd call a showman from mazzard to gizzard. So yeah, he had carnival barkers outside. Yeah, don't forget to see the preemies. Maybe the future president is inside. And yeah, he was charging admission, and he was in a carnival setting where you had carnival rides and freak shows and shoot the shoots, and that's where he was.
Dawn Raffel, she's author of The Strange Case of Dr. Cooney, How a Mysterious European Showman Saved Thousands of American Babies. On our show next, we're going to be talking about gorillas, and we're going to begin with the life and legacy of the patron saint, you could say, of gorilla studies, Diane Fossey. Remember that name? Constant Wonder will be right back after the news.